On an allergy-ridden day in May, when I was 12, I opened my dark, old gray HP laptop that buzzed like the engines of the Titanic upon hitting an iceberg, or so I imagine. I found a sketchy website, bypassed some inappropriate links and pop-up ads, you know the ones, and press play on that year's Eurovision Song Contest. Back then, Americans had no access to the show, so this was my first foray into the exciting world. Countries across Europe, and really the world now, fighting in a battle of song and dance. My closeted gay heart leapt toward the screen and my iPod became populated by my favorite songs from Eurovision. I'm a bit weird though. Most Americans didn't know what Eurovision was until like last year. Many still don't. Take Helen for instance.
In 2002, American Idol aired and my little girl brain was blown. I'd never seen anything so exciting. A contest for singing. I dreamed of joining American Idol whenever I turned 16. Something did not happen due to the fact that I was trained to sing opera, not pop, and I was way too extra in high school anyway. Besides, when I was 16, American Idol wasn't even cool anymore. It was sort of a mess. Years later, during the pandemic of 2020, my brain would be blown yet again, this time by our very own David Cirillo. David and I watched a Eurovision Song Contest, the one with Celine Dion, and I realized that America to copy something the Europeans had been doing for ages. American Idol was basically America's attempt at bottling the wonder and excitement of Eurovision. It was poorly done, yet attempted nonetheless.
That comparison, however, gives us a bit of a starting point. It's kind of like American Idol, Eurovision that is, but global. It's a magical stage where European countries, and some non-European countries nowadays, get together and dance battle, so to speak. But with glitter instead of guns.
During Eurovision, representatives from different countries perform one original song on a live televised broadcast. The winner is determined both by judges and by the votes that people get in each country. It's a bombastic display of song, diplomacy, and geopolitical alliances, political takes, rising superstars, and then some. All with a wide array of musical styles, languages, and some incredible staging and costumes. Frankly, I wish I lived in Europe, if only to enter with David.
You could always live in Australia. Not only do they participate now, but their entries are pretty operatic.
On that note, welcome to Not So Familiar History. I'm Helen Gunn.
And I'm David Cirillo.
Contest between mostly European countries. It is an exciting event, which is an understatement, that is basically like a musical Olympics with over 200 million viewers. This is way bigger than the Super Bowl, and the vast general populace of America knows little about it. I am, of course, included in this population of ignorance. Other than watching a few Eurovision Song Contests with David, the vast majority of my knowledge comes from the kitschy, wonderful movie Fire Saga, starring Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams. Fire Saga is really a love letter to the event, and with such a fun movie expressing its interest in the event, like a high school boy who only likes a girl after someone else decides to like her, I too found myself falling for the showmanship, upbeat music, and overall unity expressed through song and dance. But before we go into more detail about performances and controversies, let's look into how this cultural marvel began.
So when I first started watching Eurovision, I knew it as the embodiment of camp, not in the tent and sleeping bag kind of way, but in the ostentatious and theatrical definition. This was only in its more recent incarnation, though. We're going to take you down the twists and turns of Eurovision, starting with the 1956 inaugural competition in Lugano, Switzerland.
This contest was designed to promote cooperation between European countries following World War II through cross-border television broadcasts. It would serve to lay the foundation for the EBU, the European Broadcasting Union. After being fractured due to the Second World War and the first one before it, Europe needed some soft diplomacy to help the continent heal. This soft diplomacy would co-opt rather than coerce, basically through appeal and attractions. European powers could promote unity in the ever-changing landscape that led into the Cold War. In that first year, seven countries competed, with Switzerland taking home the win. The contest grew steadily as the years passed. This year, 40 countries will be competing. Armenia dropped out this month.
Wow.
And I don't know why, it just was announced. It was 41 countries, and then literally it said Armenia dropped out March 2021. But the contest has grown to include countries outside of Europe, such as Australia. Usually the home country of the winner hosts the contest the next year.
Also, I would actually find it so interesting if Australia won, because then it'd be hosted in Australia, and all of Europe would be watching it at like 4 a.m. or something. they would all just be voting. It'd probably be like 2 million viewers instead.
Yeah, they would be so salty. I bet you if Australia did win, like another European country would be like, we will host it in your stead.
Or maybe it's like, you can host Australia if you host it at 4 a.m.
Yes, yes, yes.
But anyways, in its earlier days, Eurovision was dominated by the same European countries, the UK, France, Italy, and the like. As Helen said, only 7 countries participated at the first. The pool of winners has since diversified, but its purpose hasn't changed.
Eurovision eventually became a way to fight in the Cold War by projecting Western appeal. This promoted an image of European unity and glamour against the USSR, who was barred from competing in the competition, and even created its own version of the contest for its bloc of states.
Which still exists, by the way.
Oh, really? They're still doing that contest?
I don't know if it's big or if everyone still participates, but it still technically exists.
So now they have, like, 2 contests they can compete in?
I guess so.
They're, like, double dipping. Those lucky dogs. This was also the chance for branding for the participating countries. They could project images and parts of their identity to define themselves and promote their countries. And this could lead to more interest in their country and even promote tourism. But circling back to the contest itself, countries submit an original song of 3 minutes max. They must perform this live for the televised event and can only have 6 people on stage. Sadly, no live animals are allowed. These strict rules appear to exist really to help with the fact that this is a live television show. You can't really control more than 6 people and live animals. And as of 1990, no one under 16 can compete. One's country of birth does not necessarily matter. Broadcasters can choose an artist from any country to represent them. And after performances, a panel of judges from the represented countries vote on the best song. They are, naturally, not allowed to vote for their own country. But the voting blocks often indicate alliances between countries, calling the fairness of the voting into question. However, since 2016, a positional voting system has been put into place where each country produces 2 sets of points, one from their professional jury and one from their general populace. This has changed the landscape of the contest as it moved from a stodgy, more formal affair to the fun concert it is known to be today.
Side note, technically I did look up the Intervision Song Contest.
Ah, that's what it was called.
Which is the Soviet bloc contest, and it hasn't technically ended, but there hasn't been a contest hosted since 2009. It's more sporadic, it seems. Because
that's not a yearly event.
Well, I think it's not even interspersed at equal intervals. It's just that there's not interest in it right now.
That's fair, because they can compete in Eurovision now. Why would they bother with that
one? I know. I digress. The performances, however, in that stodgy earlier version, as Helen said, are not to be discounted. They have been incredible since the very beginning. The productions have always been astonishing and over the top and oh so fun, especially when combined with nationalistic fervor usually reserved for the Olympics or the World Cup. You may know an Italian entry from 1958, for instance, Volare, famously covered by the likes of Frank Sinatra, David Bowie, and, my favorite, even Vitamin C for the Lizzie McGuire movie. At this time, however, as Helen said, Eurovision was still mild-mannered. It was mainly men in suits and women in flowing gowns singing ballads in front of a black tie audience. It was less a party and more of a look through your neighbor's window.
Yes, and going back to that important cultural contribution of the early 2000s, the Lizzie McGuire movie, another famous Paulo, a Portuguese one, wrote a song that spurred the 1974 Carnation Revolution in Portugal.
Sing to me, Paulo.
Although Paulo de Carvalho tied for last place with his Eurovision entry, the song was played on the radio in the days after. His song, and after the farewell, became the signal for the military coup against the authoritarian Estado Novo regime. Almost no shots were fired in this revolution, and Portugal would transform into the democratic state it is today. And it is, because David confirmed it for me.
Without any citations, so who knows? No.
He just knows a lot.
No, it's not that. I just could be wrong. Who knows?
But in the 60s and 70s, Eurovision was a way for Europeans to look around Europe while still being largely isolated from one another. Professor Brian Singleton of Trinity College Dublin once said, "You know, people growing up in that period, including myself, we only had national broadcasters. We only had access to one thing, one view of the world, one language. And one night a year, we could see people from other countries and other cultures and how different they were." Some suspect that queer folks, especially, so to speak, watched this era from home with awe and formed a special attachment to the show. At a time when social convention told men to show extreme emotional restraint, Eurovision was a welcome breath of fresh air. While it packed crowds suited up for the event like a night at the opera, perhaps with Helen performing, queer viewing parties packed households across Europe. In fact, Eurovision fan clubs with close LGBTQ links began cropping up in the 1980s. This trend would only become stronger in the 90s. Meanwhile, some immediate gay icons, as some would call them, gained prominence through Eurovision as well.
Some favorites who have competed in Eurovision include Celine Dion, ABBA, Enya, and Olivia Newton-John. Waterloo is synonymous with the contest and its turn to the theatricality of camp. This contest is the longest-running musical contest in the world. The only year it did not air since its nascence is 2020 due to the pandemic. But of course, it is not without its controversies. The lighter controversies here, basically, is that the contest has been accused of being formulaic, with artists choosing power ballads, bubblegum pop, and folk songs to appeal to a wider international audience and garner more votes.
Not to mention, they sing in English a lot of the time to garner more votes too, since that tends to work for some reason.
Yes. I don't know why. Isn't it? Well, English is the language of the UN, yes?
I mean, it's one of the languages, but it just so happens that you could sing in English or French in Eurovision Song Contest, or you could sing in your
native language.
But people tend to choose English because they tend to garner more points.
But along with that, since it is a televised contest, staging has become increasingly important. Large acts of showmanship, pyrotechnics, and dancing have appeared, allegedly, to distract viewers from subpar musical acts. This is lovingly parodied in Fire Saga, where Will Ferrell's character dances in a giant hamster wheel while surrounded by pyrotechnics. This naturally ends in disaster. But some acts really lean into the awe-inspiring visuals.
Which I love all the same, and just a sort of different genre. It reminds me of that one act specifically, it might have been from 2014 or something. We did watch it, Poland, where they had the milkmaids. It was basically all of these milkmaids who, there was this horrible song that sounded somewhat screechy. And
oh, but they had like cute costumes.
They had these cute costumes that were extraordinarily revealing. And they were just like milking these giant, like, these milk jugs on stage, and there were these old babushkas behind them too, and it's just like, it was such a big
it's like they were sexing up farm work.
Oh yeah, we love that pastoral eroticism.
Erotic cottagecore.
Anyway, these kinds of really eccentric performances really grew in the 90s. Singers leaned into the camp and the spectacle, and the gays really took over the scene, so to speak. Suddenly, crowds packed in with screaming and flags waving. Glitter was abound, and the ballad, while still around, was now in the background. A lot of rhyming there.
It was good.
Thank you. In 1998, organizers decided to make a change to the televised contest that allowed this. For the edition held in Birmingham in England, organizers decided to place a studio audience next to the stage and in front of the cameras. It was very obvious that the audience was composed mostly of gay men. It really sent a signal across Europe, so said Singleton of Trinity College Dublin. Things were also changing on stage. In 1997, Icelandic pop singer Paul Oskar became Eurovision's first openly gay contestant, although he did not win. The subsequent edition took things a step further as the Israeli transgender singer Dana International won the competition with the song Diva, a dancehall hit celebrating women from history and mythology. This was the first time that many audiences had the opportunity to see a transgender woman be so visibly successful. While Dana International torpedoed conventions on television, lawmakers too began knocking down barriers for LGBTQ members at the workplace and the military and opening up civil unions for same-sex couples around Europe. There have been major controversies in this regard, though, especially as former Soviet bloc countries enter the contest. Russia, for instance, has condemned the contest as being a Europe-wide pride parade, especially in 2014 when Conchita Wurst participated in the contest. The Austrian bearded drag queen shook the world with her song Rise Like a Phoenix, and mute this for spoilers, won in a nail-biting contest with Russia.
Yes!
We watched that, didn't we?
I don't think so.
Oh, well, it's definitely been a contest.
Let's put it on the list.
Yeah, it's definitely been a contest that I have watched in quarantine more than once. I'm happy to watch it with you again.
All right, let's do it.
But she was critiqued, I'm using she because her drag persona, Conchita Wurst, uses she, her pronouns. She was critiqued and called many slurs by officials from participating countries as a result of her win, while being celebrated and heralded by others. Eurovision, while being a place of unity, has also served as a way to target political issues on a softer stage, after all. We already discussed Eurovision sparking revolution, but these other issues played out as well.
For instance, Israel has participated in the Eurovision Song Contest 42 times since making its debut in 1973. Israel was able to enter the contest as the Israel Broadcasting Authority was an active member of the European Broadcasting Union, which is responsible for this event. The 1 year Israel didn't participate, in 1980, was the 1 year certain countries like Morocco did join. They didn't want to participate while Israel was in the contest otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And they still don't. In fact, focusing on Israel again, in 1978, when Israel, spoiler alert again, won the contest, many countries actually turned off the broadcast early for fear of broadcasting an Israeli win. Another fun fact is that Israel actually won 2 years in a row because they also won in 1979 with the song Hallelujah by Milk and Honey, which has since become a famous Israeli classic and was actually performed at Israel's 70th year of independence with an updated version because it's just so well known and celebrated throughout Israel and through a lot of Jewish communities around the world. In 2016, after Putin's Russia famously annexed Crimea in Ukraine, the tense geopolitical situation hit the Eurovision stage as well. Ukraine entered the contest with Jamala's 1944. The song took direct aim at Russian oppression in Ukraine, though Jamala swore it was not actually alluding to anything too specific. The song addresses Stalin's deportation of the entire Tatar population of Crimea in May of 1944. Almost a quarter of a million Tatars, an ethnically Turkic population indigenous to the Crimea, were moved to Central Asia in what became, according to some, an attempted genocide. Spoilers again, Ukraine won this contest, becoming a soft condemnation of Russia and a show of support for Ukraine. It also marked a noticeable change in voting blocs. Traditionally, Ukraine would vote for Russia and Russia for Ukraine. Instead, the bloc splintered. This may be a good time to explain the voting system more in depth, as Helen alluded to earlier. The competitors don't exactly come in on an even playing field. While sometimes songs can win on pure mass appeal, like Conchita's or Jamala's songs, there is a lot of bias in who wins Eurovision. Certain countries tend to vote for each other in high numbers. The former Soviet bloc all votes for each other. Cyprus and Greece vote for each other as well. Scandinavian countries support each other, and similarly important, no one votes for England. That's because of how Eurovision voting actually works. Each country, through a combination of viewer voting and ruling from appointed competition judges, ranks all the other performances from 12 to 1. And also 0, I suppose, for the countries that get no votes. The performance with the highest point total wins. In past years, the rankings have been determined half by popular voting and half by the judging panel from each country, but in 2016, rankings and voting, as Helen alluded to earlier, started to be counted separately, with each counting for up to 12 points. France's judges could award you 12 points, for example, and the French voters award you none. This way, every country could have an equal say, but it also lends a lot of bias. Also, it really extends the vote totals up, skyrocketing. So when the Ukrainian and Russian split on the Eurovision stage mirrored that on the political stage, the reasons were clear. And the fact that certain former Soviet bloc countries, especially those like Georgia, which had gone through similar annexations, gave us 12 points to Ukraine, it was an even bigger statement.
And these statements are not limited to voting decisions. When Israeli singer Netta won the 2018 Eurovision contest, she announced that the next Eurovision contest would occur next year in Jerusalem. It ended up being in Tel Aviv, but the sentiment was the same. Eurovision in 2019 occurred in Israel. Israel's becoming the host nation of the contest spurred demands of boycotts, sanctions, and divestments over their involvement in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Days before rehearsal started, Israeli forces and militants in Gaza traded fire along the border, leading to injuries and even deaths. As the contest continued preparations, the worry that more attacks would occur persisted. But in terms of activism, the most notable occurrence came from Iceland's punk BDSM band Hadari, who sang us a bleak prediction of Europe's future called Hate Will Prevail, and even waved a Free Palestine flag while filmed after their performance.
I screamed when I saw that. Not saying good or bad, I don't want to get too political, but it was a good scream. but I do remember a lot of people were saying to not even watch Eurovision on TV that year, because I believe in 2018 it was aired on Logo, which is an LGBTQ network in the United States, to not give it ratings because it was so controversial that it was being held in Israel.
But that move by Hatari, that was exciting. I saw it like a year after the fact and I was still like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like that was
surprise.
Gutsy.
Also, fun fact, 2019, in my opinion, has the best songs of any Eurovision Song Contest, and it just happens to be the most recent contest, if you want to start with any of them.
Mm-hmm. 2020, also.
I mean, Friend of a Friend is my favorite song, but also Australia's act was pretty fun.
Australia, quite literally, had a beautiful operatic performance of people on these bendable sticks. They looked like Dementors flying in the air.
Yeah, they were just swaying the whole time.
It was so insane from a visual standpoint, but at the same time the actual vocal performance was brilliant.
Oh, so good.
So it was insane to me. And Arcade by the Netherlands, obviously. Sweden's always a powerhouse. That's something to know. And 2020 actually even had its fair share of breakout performances from Eurovision, even though the song contest did not air. For instance, Iceland had an amazing entry that I listen to all the time. What's it called?
Is it Double Trouble?
No, it's not. For instance, Iceland in 2020 had an amazing entry that many thought was going to actually win the contest, called Think About Things, which went viral. I'm not sure on what platform, probably TikTok, but it went viral also on Twitter and a bunch of other platforms because it's just such a fun and amazing song. And there are a bunch of other fantastic songs also that were going to be performed in 2020. And I'm so sad that the Eurovision Song Contest was canceled, but alas, it's a pandemic.
It'll be back this year. It's supposed to air in May.
It will be back this year, probably with no audience, I would assume, or at least a very reduced capacity. And I recommend you listen to the 2020 song, specifically Think About Things. Regardless, Eurovision has been around for decades. It's seen its fair share of superstars. It's become a hub for queer culture. It's persevered through international conflict and become a stage to express political opinion. It may seem like a silly song contest full of camp, and it is, but there's a lot of meaning behind that glitter and glitz. And as more and more non-European countries join the party, for instance, Australia is now a fixture, countries like Azerbaijan have won the contest, and there are even rumors of China potentially joining soon enough, the meaning of the Eurovision Song Contest is bound to expand even further. Side note, for all my Americans out there, you don't have to watch on a sketchy site anymore. Netflix got the rights to start airing Eurovision starting in 2020.
Well, thank you so much for listening to our latest episode of Not So Familiar History. We are available basically anywhere you find your podcasts. And
this is the Icelandic entry.
Oh, God.
But yeah, thank you for listening. We're on most platforms. See ya in 2 weeks.